Hugh Priest and Billy Tupper were both dead. That news had come in just as Sheila was beginning to fall apart. The call came from a beer delivery man who'd had the sense to call medical assistance before calling the sheriff. The man had been almost as hysterical as Sheila Brigham, and Alan hadn't blamed him. By then, he had been feeling pretty hysterical himself. Henry Beaufort, in critical condition as a result of multiple gunshot wounds. Norris Ridgwick, missing, and that somehow hurt the most. Alan had looked around for him after receiving the delivery man's call, but Norris was just gone. Alan had assumed at the time that he must have gone outside to formally arrest Danforth and would return with the head selectman in tow, but events shortly proved that no one had arrested Keaton. Alan supposed the Stateys would arrest him if they ran across him while they pursued other lines of investigation, but otherwise, no. They had more important things to do. In the meantime, Norris was just gone. Wherever he was, he'd gotten there on foot. When Alan left town, Norris's VW had still been lying on its side in the middle of Lower Main Street. The witnesses said Buster had crawled into his Cadillac through the window and simply driven away. The only person who had tried to stop him had paid a steep price. Scott Garson was hospitalized here at Northern Cumberland with a broken jaw, broken cheekbone, broken wrist, and 3 broken fingers. It could have been worse. The bystanders claimed Buster had actively tried to run the man down as he lay in the street. Lenny Partridge, broken collarbone, 2 broken ribs, was also here someplace. Andy Clutterbuck had weighed in with news of this fresh disaster while Alan was still trying to comprehend the fact that the town's head selectman was now a fugitive from justice handcuffed to a big red Cadillac. Hugh Priest had apparently stopped Lenny, tossed him across the road, and driven away in the old man's car. Alan supposed they would find Lenny's car in the parking lot of the Mellow Tiger, since Hugh had bitten the dust there. And, of course, there was Brian Rusk, who had eaten a bullet at the ripe old age of 11. Clut had barely begun to tell his tale when the phone rang again. Sheila was gone by then, and Alan had picked up on the voice of a screaming, hysterical little boy, Sean Rusk, who had dialed the number on the bright orange sticker beside the kitchen telephone. All in all, medical assistance ambulances and rescue service units from 4 different towns had made afternoon stops in Castle Rock. Now, sitting with his back to Simple Simon in the pieman, watching the plastic birds as they swung and dipped around their spindle, Alan turned once more to Hugh and Lenny Partridge. Their confrontation was hardly the biggest to take place in Castle Rock today, but it was one of the oddest, and Alan sensed that a key to this business might be hidden in its very oddity. Why in God's name didn't Hugh take his own car if he had a hard-on for Henry Beaufort? Alan had asked Clut, running his hands through hair which was already wildly disarranged. Why bother with Lenny's old piece of shit? Because Hugh's Buick was standing on 4 flats. Looked like somebody ripped the shit out of them with a knife. Clut had shrugged, looking uneasily at the shambles the sheriff's office had become. Maybe he thought Henry Beaufort did it. Yes, Alan thought now, maybe so. It was crazy, but was it any crazier than Wilma Jurczyk thinking Nettie Cobb had first splattered mud on her sheets and then thrown rocks through the windows of her house? Any crazier than Nettie thinking Wilma had killed her dog? Before he had a chance to question Clut any further, Henry Payton had come in and told Alan, as kindly as he could, that he was taking the case. Alan nodded. There's one thing you need to find out, Henry, as soon as you can. What's that, Alan? Henry had asked, but Alan saw, with a sinking feeling, that Henry was listening to him with only half an ear. His old friend, the first real friend Alan had made in the wider law enforcement community after winning the job as sheriff, and a very valuable friend he had turned out to be, was already concentrating on other things. How he would deploy his forces, given the widespread of the incidents, was probably chief among them. You need to find out if Henry Beaufort was as angry at Hugh Priest as Hugh apparently was with him. You can't ask him now. I understand he's unconscious, but when he wakes up... Will do, Henry said and clapped Alan on the shoulder. Will do. Then, raising his voice, Brooks, Morrison, over here. Alan watched him move off and thought of going after him, of grabbing him and making him listen. He didn't do it because Henry and Hugh and Lester and John, even Wilma and Nettie, were beginning to lose any feeling of real importance to him. The dead were dead. The wounded were being looked after. The crimes had been committed. Except Alan had a terrible sneaking suspicion that the real crime was still going on. When Henry had walked away to brief his men, Alan had called Clut over once again. The deputy came with his hands stuffed into his pockets and a morose look on his face. We've been replaced, Alan, he said, taken right out of the picture. God damn! Not entirely, Alan said, hoping he sounded as if he really believed this. You're going to be my liaison here, Clut. Where are you going? To the Rusk house. But when he got there, both Brian and Sean Rusk were gone. The ambulance, which was taking care of the unfortunate Scott Garson, had swung by to pick up Sean. They were on their way to Northern Cumberland Hospital. Harry Samuels' second hearse, an old converted Lincoln, had gotten Brian Rusk and would take him to Oxford, pending autopsy. Harry's better hearse, the one he referred to as the company car, had already left for the same place with Hugh and Billy Tupper. Alan thought, the bodies will be stacked in that tiny morgue over there like cordwood. It was when he got to the Rusk home that Alan realized, in his gut as well as in his head, how completely he had been taken out of the play. Two of Henry's CID men were there ahead of him, and they made it clear that Alan could hang around only as long as he didn't try to stick in an oar and help them row. He had stood in the kitchen doorway for a moment, watching them, feeling about as useful as a third wheel on a motor scooter. Cora Rusk's responses were slow, almost doped. Alan thought it might be shock, or perhaps the ambulance attendants who were transporting her remaining son to the hospital had given her some prescription mercy before they left. She reminded him eerily of the way Norris had looked as he had crawled from the window of his overturned VW. Whether it was because of a tranquilizer or just shock, the detectives weren't getting much value from her. She wasn't quite weeping, but she was clearly unable to concentrate on their questions enough to make helpful responses. She didn't know anything, she told them. She had been upstairs, taking a nap. Poor Brian, she kept saying. Poor, poor Brian. But she expressed this sentiment in a drone which Alan found creepy, and she kept toying with a pair of old sunglasses which lay beside her on the kitchen table. One of the bows had been mended with adhesive tape, and one of the lenses was cracked. Alan had left in disgust and come here to the hospital. Now he got up and went to the pay telephone down the hall in the main lobby. He tried Polly again, got no answer, and then dialed the sheriff's office. The voice which answered growled, "State Police!" and Alan felt a childish surge of jealousy. He identified himself and asked for Clut. After a wait of almost 5 minutes, Clut came on the line. "Sorry, Alan. They just let the phone lay there on the desk. Lucky I came over to check it, you'd still be waiting. Darned old stadies don't care one bit about us." "Don't worry about it, Clut. Has anyone collared Keaton yet?" "Well, I don't know how to tell you this, Alan, but..." Alan felt a sinking in the pit of his stomach and closed his eyes. He had been right. It wasn't over. "Just tell me," he said. "Never mind the protocol." "Buster, Danforth, I mean, drove home and used a screwdriver to knock the door handle off his Cadillac. You know, where he was cuffed." "I know," Alan agreed. His eyes were still shut. "Well, he killed his wife, Alan, with a hammer. It wasn't a state cop that found her, because the stadies weren't much interested in Buster up to 20 minutes ago. It was Seat Thomas. He drove by Buster's house to double-check. He reported in what he found and got back here not 5 minutes ago. He's having chest pains, he says, and I'm not surprised. He told me that Buster took her face about right off, said there's guts and hair every place. There's a platoon or so of Peyton's blue jackets up there on the view now. I put Seat in your office. Figured he'd better sit down before he fell down." "Jesus Christ, Clut. Take him over to Ray Van Allen, fast. He's 62 and been smoking Camels all his damn life." "Ray went to Oxford, Alan. He's trying to help the doctors patch up Henry Beaufort." "His PA, then. What's his name?"
"Frankel. Everett Frankel."
"Not around. I tried both the office and his house."
"Well, what's his wife say?"
"Eb's a bachelor, Alan." "Oh, Christ." Someone had scrawled a bit of graffiti over the telephone. "Don't worry, be happy," it said. Alan considered this sourly.
"I can take him to the hospital myself," Clut offered.
"I need you right where you are," Alan said. "Have the reporters and TV people shown up?"
"Yeah, the place is crawling with them."
"Well, check on Seat as soon as we're done here. If he doesn't feel any better, here's what you do. Go out front, grab a reporter who looks halfway bright to you, deputize him, and have him drive Seat over here to Northern Cumberland."
"Okay."
Clut hesitated, then burst out,
"I wanted to go over to the Keaton place, but the state police, they won't let me onto the crime scene." "How do you like that, Alan? Those bastards won't let a county deputy sheriff onto the crime scene."
"I know how you feel. I don't like it much myself, but they're doing their job.
Can you see Seat from where you are, Clut?
Yeah.
Well, is he alive?
He's sitting behind your desk, smoking a cigarette and looking at this month's rural law enforcement.
Right, Alan said.
He felt like laughing or crying or doing both at the same time.
That figures. Has Polly Chalmers called, Clut?
No. Wait a minute. Here's the log. I thought it was gone. She did call Alan, just before 3:30.
Alan grimaced. I know about that one. Anything later?
Not that I can see here, but that doesn't mean much. With Sheila gone and these darned old state bears clumping around, who can tell for sure?
Thanks, Clut. Is there anything else I should know?
Yeah, a couple of things.
Shoot.
They've got the gun Hugh used to shoot Henry, but David Friedman from State Police Ballistics says he doesn't know what it is. An automatic pistol of some kind, but the guy said he's never seen one quite like it.
Are you sure it was David Friedman? Alan asked.
Friedman, yeah, that was the guy's name.
He must know. Dave Friedman's a walking shooter's Bible.
Yeah, he doesn't, though. I stood right there while he was talking to your pal Peyton. He said it's a little like a German Mauser, but it lacked the normal markings and the slide was different. I think they sent it to Augusta with about a ton of other evidence.
What else?
They found an anonymous note in Henry Beaufort's yard, Clut said. It was crumpled into a ball beside his car. You know that classic T-Bird of his? It was vandalized, too, just like Hugh's.
Alan felt as if a large, soft hand had just whacked him across the face.
What did the note say, Clut?
Just a minute. He heard a faint, quick, quick sound as Clut paged through his notebook.
Here it is. Don't you ever cut me off and then keep my car keys, you damn frog.
Frog?
That's what it says. Clut giggled nervously. The word ever and the word frog have got lines drawn under them.
And you say the car was vandalized?
That's right. Tires slashed, just like Hugh's, and a big long scratch down the passenger side.
Ouch.
Okay, Alan said. Here's something else for you to do. Go to the barber shop and then to the billiard parlor if you need to. Find out who it was Henry cut off, this week or last.
But the state police...
Fuck the state police, Alan said feelingly. It's our town. We know who to ask and where to find them. Do you want to tell me you can't lay hands on someone who'll know this story in just about 5 minutes?
Of course not, Clut said. I saw Charlie Fortin when I came back from Castle Hill, noodling with a bunch of guys in front of the Western Auto. If Henry was bumping heads with somebody, Charlie will know who. Hell, the Tiger's Charlie's home away from home.
Yes, but were the state police questioning him?
Well, no,
no. So you question him. But I think we both already know the answer, don't we?
Hugh Priest, Clut said.
It has the unmistakable clang of a ringer to me, Alan said.
He thought, this is maybe not so different from Henry Peyton's first guess after all.
Okay, Alan, I'll get on it. And call me back the minute you know for sure, the second.
He gave Clut the number, then made him recite it back so he could be sure Clut had copied it down correctly.
I will, Clut said, and then burst out furiously. What's going on, Alan? God damn it, what's going on around here?
I don't know. Alan felt very old, very tired, and angry. No longer angry at Peyton for shunning him off the case, but angry at whoever was responsible for these gruesome fireworks. And he felt more and more sure that when they got to the bottom of it, they would discover that a single agency had been at work all along. Wilma and Nettie, Henry and Hugh, Lester and John. Someone had wired them together like packets of high explosive.
I don't know, Clut, but we're going to find out.
He hung up and dialed Polly's number again. His urge to make things right with her, to understand what had happened to make her so furious with him, was fading. The replacement feeling, which had begun to creep over him, was even less comforting. A deep, unfocused dread, a growing feeling that she was in danger. Ring, 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 but no answer. Polly, I love you and we need to talk. Please pick up the phone. Polly, I love you and we need to talk. Please pick up the phone. Polly, I love you. The litany ran around in his head like a wind-up toy. He wanted to call Clut back and ask him to check on her right away, before he did anything else, but couldn't. That would be very wrong when there might be other packets of explosives still waiting to explode in the rock.
Yes, but Alan, suppose Polly's one of them.
That thought poked some buried association loose, but he was unable to grasp it before it floated away. Alan slowly hung up the telephone, cutting it off in mid-ring as he settled it into its cradle.
Polly could stand it no longer. She rolled on her side, reached for the telephone, and it stilled in mid-ring. Good, she thought. But was it? She was lying on her bed, listening to the sound of approaching thunder. It was hot upstairs, as hot as the middle of July. But opening the windows was not an option, because she'd had Dave Phillips, one of the local handymen and caretakers, put on her storm windows and doors just the week before. So she had taken off the old jeans and shirt she had worn on her expedition to the country and folded them neatly over the chair by the door. Now she lay on the bed in her underwear, wanting a little nap before she got up and showered, but unable to go to sleep. Some of it was the sirens, but more of it was Alan, what Alan had done. She could not comprehend this grotesque betrayal of all she had believed and all she had trusted, but neither could she escape it. Her mind would turn to something else, those sirens, for instance, and how they sounded like the end of the world. And then, suddenly, it would be there again, how he had gone behind her back, how he had sneaked. It was like being poked by the splintery end of a board in some tender, secret place. "Oh, Alan, how could you?" she asked him, and herself, again. The voice which replied surprised her. It was Aunt Evie's voice, and beneath the dry lack of sentiment that had always been her way, Polly felt a disquieting, powerful anger. "If you had told him the truth in the first place, girl, he never would have had to." Polly sat up quickly. That was a disturbing voice, all right, and the most disturbing thing about it was the fact that it was her own voice. Aunt Evie was many years dead. This was her own subconscious, using Aunt Evie to express its anger, the way a shy ventriloquist might use his dummy to ask a pretty girl for a date and... "Stop it, girl. Didn't I once tell you this town is full of ghosts? Maybe it is me. Maybe it is." Polly uttered a whimpering, frightened cry, and then pressed her hand against her mouth. "Oh, maybe it isn't. In the end, who it is don't matter much, does it? The question is this, Tricia. Who sinned first? Who lied first? Who covered up first? Who cast the first stone?" "That's not fair," Polly shouted into the hot room, and then looked at her own frightened, wide-eyed reflection in the bedroom mirror. She waited for the voice of Aunt Evie to come back, and when it didn't, she slowly lay back down again. Perhaps she had sinned first, if omitting part of the truth and telling a few white lies was sinning. Perhaps she had covered up first. But did that give Alan the right to open an investigation on her, the way a law officer might open an investigation on a known felon? Did it give him the right to put her name on some interstate law enforcement wire, or send out a tracer on her, if that was what they called it, or... "Never mind, Polly." A voice, one she knew, whispered, "Stop tearing yourself apart over what was very proper behavior on your part. I mean, after all, you heard the guilt in his voice, didn't you?" "Yes," she muttered fiercely into the pillow. "That's right, I did. What about that, Aunt Evie?" There was no answer, only a queer, light tugging. "The question is this, Tricia," at her subconscious mind. As if she had forgotten something, left something out. "Would you like a sweet, Tricia?" of the equation. Polly rolled restlessly onto her side, and the Azka tumbled across the fullness of one breast. She heard something inside scratch delicately at the silver wall of its prison. "No," Polly thought, "it's just something shifting, something inert. This idea that there really is something alive in there, it's just your imagination." Scratch, scritch, scratch. The silver ball jiggled minutely between the white cotton cup of her bra and the coverlet of the bed. Scratchy, scritch, scratch. "That thing is alive, Tricia," Aunt Evie said. "That thing is alive, and you know it." "Don't be silly," Polly told her, tossing over to the other side. "How could there possibly be some creature in there? I suppose it might be able to breathe through all those tiny holes, but what in God's name would it eat?" "Maybe," Aunt Evie replied with a soft implacability, "it's eating you, Tricia." "Polly," she murmured. "My name is Polly." This time the tug at her subconscious mind was stronger, somehow alarming, and for a moment she was almost able to grasp it. Then the telephone began to ring again. She gasped and sat up, her face wearing a look of tired dismay. Pride and longing were at war there. "Talk to him, Tricia. What can it hurt? Better still..." listen to him. You didn't do much of that before, did you? I don't want to talk to him, not after what he did. But you still love him. Yes, that was true. The only thing was, now she hated him as well. The voice of Aunt Evie rose once more, gusting angrily in her mind. Do you want to be a ghost all your life, Tricia? What's the matter with you, girl? Polly reached out for the telephone in a mockery of decisiveness. Her hand, her limber, pain-free hand, faltered just short of the handset. Because maybe it wasn't Alan. Maybe it was Mr. Gaunt. Maybe Mr. Gaunt wanted to tell her that he wasn't finished with her yet, that she hadn't finished paying yet. She made another move toward the telephone. This time the tips of her fingers actually brushed the plastic casing, and then she drew back. Her hand clutched its partner, and they folded into a nervous ball on her belly. She was afraid of Aunt Evie's dead voice, of what she had done this afternoon, of what Mr. Gaunt, or Alan, might tell the town about her dead son, of what yonder confusion of sirens and racing cars might mean. But more than all of these things, she had discovered, she was afraid of Leland Gaunt himself. She felt as if someone had tied her to the clapper of a great iron bell, a bell which would simultaneously deafen her, drive her mad, and crush her to a pulp if it began to ring. The telephone fell quiet. Outside, another siren began to scream, and as it began to fade toward the tin bridge, the thunder rolled again, closer than ever now. Take it off. The voice of Aunt Evie whispered. Take it off, honey. You can do it. His power is over need, not will. Take it off. Break his hold on you. But she was looking at the telephone and remembering the night, was it less than a week ago, when she had reached for it and struck it with her fingers, knocking it to the floor. She remembered the pain which had clawed its way up her arm like a hungry rat with broken teeth. She couldn't go back to that. She just couldn't. Could she? Something nasty's going on in the rock tonight, Aunt Evie said. Do you want to wake up tomorrow and have to figure out how much of it was your nastiness? Is that really a score you want to add up, Tricia? You don't understand, she moaned. It wasn't on Alan. It was on Ace. Ace Merrill, and he deserves whatever he gets. The implacable voice of Aunt Evie returned. And so do you, honey. So do you. At 6:20 on that Tuesday evening, as the thunderheads neared and real dark began to overtake twilight, the state police officer who had replaced Sheila Brigham in dispatch came out into the sheriff's office bullpen. He skirted the large area, roughly diamond-shaped, which was marked with crime scene tape, and hurried over to where Henry Peyton stood. Peyton looked disheveled and unhappy. He had spent the previous 5 minutes with the ladies and gentlemen of the press, and he felt as he always did after one of these confrontations, as if he had been coated with honey and then forced to roll in a large pile of ant-infested hyena shit. His statement had not been as well prepared or as unassailably vague as he would have liked. The TV people had forced his hand. They wanted to do live updates during the 6 to 6:30 time slot when the local news was broadcast, felt they had to do live updates, and if he didn't throw them some kind of a bone, they were apt to crucify him at 11. They had almost crucified him anyway. He had come as close as he ever had in his entire career to admitting he didn't have a fucking clue. He had not left this impromptu press conference. He had escaped it. Peyton found himself wishing he had listened more closely to Alan. When he arrived, it had seemed that the job was essentially damage control. Now he wondered, because there had been another murder since he took the case, a woman named Myrtle Keaton. Her husband was still out there someplace, probably headed over the hills and far away by now, but just possibly still galloping gaily around this weird little town. A man who had offed his wife with a hammer. A prime psycho, in other words. The trouble was, he didn't know these people. Alan and his deputies did, but both Alan and Ridgwick were gone. LaPointe was in the hospital, probably hoping the doctors could get his nose on straight again. He looked around for Clutterbuck and was somehow not surprised to see that he had also melted away. You want it, Henry? He heard Alan say inside his head. Fine, take it. And as far as suspects go, why not try the phone book?
Lieutenant Peyton? Lieutenant Peyton. It was the officer from dispatch.
What?
Henry growled. I've got Dr. Van Allen on the radio. He wants to talk to you.
About what?
He wouldn't say. He only told me he had to speak to you. Henry Peyton walked into the dispatcher's office feeling more and more like a kid riding a bike with no brakes down a steep hill with a drop-off on one side, a rock wall on the other, and a pack of hungry wolves with reporters' faces behind him. He picked up the mic. This is Peyton. Come back. Lieutenant Peyton, this is Dr. Van Allen, County Medical Examiner. The voice was hollow and distant, broken up occasionally by heavy bursts of static. That would be the approaching storm, Henry knew. More fun with Dick and Jane. Yes, I know who you are, Henry said. You took Mr. Beaufort to Oxford. How is he? Come back? He's crackle, crackle, buzz snacker. You're breaking up, Dr. Van Allen, Henry said, speaking as patiently as he could. We've got what looks to be a really first-class electrical storm on the way here. Please say again, okay? Dead! Van Allen shouted through a break in the static. He died in the ambulance, but we do not believe it was gunshot trauma which killed him. Do you understand? We do not believe this patient died of gunshot trauma. His brain first underwent atypical edema and then ruptured. The most likely diagnosis is that some toxic substance, some extremely toxic substance, was introduced into his blood when he was shot. This same substance appears to have literally burst his heart open. Please acknowledge. Oh, Jesus, Henry Peyton thought. He pulled down his tie, unbuttoned his collar, and then pressed the transmit button again. I acknowledge your message, Dr. Van Allen, but I'll be damned if I understand it, Kay. The toxin was very likely on the bullets in the gun that shot him. The infection appears to spread slowly at first, then to pick up speed. We have two clear, fan-shaped areas of introduction here, the cheek wound and the chest wound. It's very important to... Crack, snackle, buzz it. Has it? 10-4? Say again, Dr. Van Allen. Henry wished to Christ the man had simply picked up the telephone. Please say again. Come back. Who has that gun? Van Allen shrieked. 10-4! David Friedman, ballistics. He's taken it to Augusta. K. Would he have unloaded it first? 10-4? Yes, that's standard practice. Come back. Was it a revolver or an automatic, Lieutenant Peyton? That's of prime importance right now. 10-4. An automatic. K. Would he have unloaded the clip? 10-4? He'd do that at Augusta. Peyton sat down heavily in the dispatcher's chair. Suddenly, he needed to take a heavy dump. 10-4. No, no, he mustn't. He must not do that. Do you copy? I copy, Henry said. I'll leave a message for him at the ballistics lab saying he's to leave the goddamn bullets in the goddamn clip until we get this latest goddamn snafu sorted the goddamn hell out. He felt a childish pleasure at the realization that this was going out on the air, and then he wondered how many of the reporters out front were monitoring him on their Bearcats. Listen, Dr. Van Allen, we've got no business talking about this on the radio, 10-4. Never mind the public relations aspect, Van Allen came back harshly. We're talking about a man's life here, Lieutenant Peyton. I tried to get you on the telephone and couldn't get through. Tell your man Friedman to examine his hands carefully for scratches, small nicks, even hangnails. If he has the smallest break in the skin of his hands, he's to go to the nearest hospital immediately. I have no way of knowing if the crap we're dealing with was on the casing of the ammunition clip as well as on the bullets themselves. And it isn't the kind of thing he wants to take the slightest chance with. This stuff is deadly. 10-4? I acknowledge, Henry heard himself say. He found himself wishing he were anywhere but here. But since he was here, he wished that Alan Pangborn were here beside him. Since arriving in Castle Rock, he had come more and more to feel like Br'er Rabbit stuck in the tar baby. What is it, Kay? We don't know yet. Not curare, because there was no paralysis until the very end. Also, curare is relatively painless, and Mr. Beaufort suffered a great deal. All we know right now is that it started slowly and then moved like a freight train. 10-4? That's all? 10-4? Jesus Christ, Ray Van Allen ejaculated. Isn't it enough? 10-4. Yes, I guess it is, Kay. Just be glad. Crackle, crackle, brack. Say again, Dr. Van Allen. Say again. 10-4. Through the swelling ocean of static, he heard Dr. Van Allen say, just be glad you've got the gun in custody, that you don't have to worry about it doing any more damage. 10-4. You got that right, buddy. 10-40 out.
Cora Rusk turned onto Main Street and walked slowly toward Needful Things. She passed a bright yellow Ford Econoline van with WPTD Channel 5 Action News emblazoned on the side, but did not see Danforth Buster Keaton looking out of the driver's window at her with unblinking eyes. She probably wouldn't have recognized him in any case. Buster had become, in a manner of speaking, a new man. And even if she had seen and recognized him, it would have meant nothing to Cora. She had her own problems and sorrows. Most of all, she had her own anger, and none of this concerned her dead son. In one hand, Cora Rusk held a pair of broken sunglasses. It had seemed to her that the police were going to question her forever, or at least until she went mad. "Go away," she wanted to scream at them. "Stop asking me all these stupid questions about Brian. Arrest him if he's in trouble. His father will fix it. Fixing things is all he's good for, but leave me alone. I've got a date with the king, and I can't keep him waiting." At one point, she had seen Sheriff Pangborn leaning in the doorway between the kitchen and the back stoop, his arms folded across his chest, and she had been on the verge of blurting this out, thinking he would understand. He wasn't like these others. He was from town. He would know about Needful Things. He would have bought his own special item there. He would understand. Except Mr. Gaunt had spoken up in her mind just then, as calm and as reasonable as ever. "No, Cora, don't talk to him. He wouldn't understand. He's not like you. He's not a smart shopper. Tell them you want to go to the hospital and see your other boy. That will get rid of them, at least for a while. After that, it won't matter." So she had told them just that, and it worked like a charm. She had even managed to squeeze out a tear or two, thinking not about Brian, but about how sad Elvis must feel, wandering around Graceland without her. Poor lost king. They had left, all but the two or three who were out in the garage. Cora didn't know what they were doing or what they could possibly want out there, and she didn't care. She grabbed her magic sunglasses off the table and hurried upstairs. Once she was in her room, she slipped out of her robe, lay down on her bed, and put them on. At once, she was in Graceland again. Relief, anticipation, and amazing horniness filled her. She swept up the curving staircase, cool and nude, to the upstairs hall, hung with jungle tapestries and nearly as wide as a freeway. She walked down to the closed double doors at the far end, her bare feet whispering in the deep nap of the carpet. She saw her fingers reach out and close around the handles. She pushed the doors open, revealing the king's bedroom. A room which was all black and white. Black walls, white shag rug, black drapes over the windows, white trim on the black bedspread. Except for the ceiling, which was painted midnight blue with 1,000 twinkly electric stars. Then she looked at the bed, and that was when the horror struck. The king was on the bed, but the king was not alone. Sitting on top of him, riding him like a pony, was Myra Evans. She had turned her head and stared at Cora when the doors opened. The king only kept looking up at Myra, blinking those sleepy, beautiful blue eyes of his. "Myra!" Cora had exclaimed. "What are you doing here?" "Well," Myra said smugly, "I'm sure not vacuuming the floor." Cora gasped for breath, utterly stunned.
Well, I'll be butched!" she cried,
her voice rising as her wind returned. "Then go be butched," Myra said, pumping her hips faster, "and take those silly sunglasses off while you're at it. They look stupid. Get out of here. Go back to Castle Rock. We're busy, aren't we, E?"
"Oh, that's right, sweet thing," the king said. "Just as busy as two twiddly bugs in a carpet."
Horror turned to fury, and Cora's paralysis broke with a snap. She rushed at her so-called friend, meaning to rip her deceitful eyes from their sockets. But when she raised one clawed hand to do so, Myra reached out, never missing a stroke with her pumping hips as she did, and tore the sunglasses from Cora's face with her own hand. Cora had squeezed her eyes shut in surprise, and when she opened them, she had been lying in her own bed again. The sunglasses were on the floor, both lenses shattered.
"No!"
Cora moaned, lurching out of bed. She wanted to shriek, but some inner voice, not her own, warned her that the police in the garage would hear if she did, and come running.
"No, please, no, please, please!"
She tried to fit chunks of the broken lenses back into the streamlined gold frames, but it had been impossible. They were broken. Broken by that evil, whoring slut. Broken by her friend, Myra Evans. Her friend, who had somehow found her own way to Graceland. Her friend, who was even now, as Cora tried to put together a priceless artifact that was irretrievably broken, making love to the king. Cora looked up. Her eyes had become glittering black slits.
"I'll butch her," she had whispered hoarsely. "See if I don't."
She read the sign in the window of Needful Things, paused for a moment, thinking, and then walked around to the service alley. She brushed by Francine Pelletier, who was on her way out of the alley, putting something into her purse. Cora hardly even looked at her. Halfway down the alley, she saw Mr. Gaunt standing behind a wooden table, which lay across the open back door of his shop like a barricade.
"Ah, Cora," he exclaimed. "I was wondering when you'd drop by."
"That bitch!" Cora spat. "That double-crossing little slut bitch!"
"Pardon me, Cora," Mr. Gaunt said with urbane politeness, "but you seem to have missed a button or two." He pointed one of his odd and long fingers at the front of her dress. Cora had slipped the first thing she'd found in the closet on over her nakedness and had managed to do only the top button. Below that one, the dress gaped open to the curls of her pubic hair. Her belly, swelled by a great many ring-dings, yodels, and chocolate-covered cherries during Santa Barbara and all her other shows, curved smoothly out.
"Who gives a shit?" Cora snapped.
"Not I," Mr. Gaunt agreed serenely.
"How may I help you?"
"That bitch is fucking the king. She broke my sunglasses. I want to kill her."
"Do you?"
Mr. Gaunt said, raising his eyebrows.
"Well, I can't say that I don't sympathize, Cora, because I do. It may be that a woman who would steal another woman's man deserves to live. I wouldn't care to say on that subject one way or the other. I've been a businessman all my life, and know very little about matters of the heart. But a woman who deliberately breaks another woman's most treasured possession, well, that is a much more serious thing. Do you agree?" She began to smile. It was a hard smile. It was a merciless smile. It was a smile utterly devoid of sanity.
"Too fucking right," said Cora Rusk. Mr. Gaunt turned around for a moment. When he faced Cora again, he was holding an automatic pistol in one hand.
"Might you be looking for something like this?" he asked.
After Buster finished with Myrtle, he fell into a deep fugue state. All sense of purpose seemed to desert him. He thought of them. The whole town was crawling with them. But instead of the clear, righteous anger the idea had brought only minutes before, he now felt only weariness and depression. He had a pounding headache. His arm and back ached from wielding the hammer. He looked down and saw that he was still holding it. He opened his hand, and it fell to the kitchen linoleum, making a bloody splatter there. He stood looking at this splatter for almost a full minute with a kind of idiot attention. It looked to him like a sketch of his father's face, drawn in blood. He plodded through the living room and into his study, rubbing his shoulder and upper arm as he went. The handcuff chain jingled maddeningly. He opened the closet door, dropped to his knees, crawled beneath the clothes which hung at the front, and dug out the box with the pacers on the front. He backed clumsily out of the closet again, the handcuff caught in one of Myra's shoes, and he threw it to the back of the closet with a sulky curse. Took the box over to his desk and sat down with it in front of him. Instead of excitement, he felt only sadness. Winning ticket was wonderful, all right, but what good could it possibly do him now? It didn't matter if he put the money back or not. He had murdered his wife. She had undoubtedly deserved it, but they wouldn't see it that way. They would happily throw him into the deepest, darkest Shawshank penitentiary cell they could find and throw away the key. He saw that he had left large, bloody smears on the box top, and he looked down at himself. For the first time, he noticed that he was covered with blood. His meaty forearms looked as though they belonged to a Chicago hog butcher. Depression folded over him again in a soft, black wave. They had beaten him. Okay. Yet he would escape them. He would escape them just the same. He got up, weary to his very center, and plodded slowly upstairs. He undressed as he went, kicking off his shoes in the living room, dropping his pants at the foot of the stairs, then sitting down halfway up to peel off his socks. Even they were bloody. The shirt gave him the hardest time. Pulling off a shirt while you were wearing a handcuff was the devil's own job. Almost 20 minutes passed between the murder of Mrs. Keaton and Buster's trudge to and through the shower. He might have been taken into custody without a problem at almost any time during that period. But on Lower Main Street, a transition of authority was going on. The sheriff's office was in almost total disarray, and the whereabouts of Danforth, Buster, Keaton simply did not seem very important. Once he had toweled dry, he put on a clean pair of pants and a T-shirt. He didn't have the energy to tussle again with long sleeves, and went back down to his office. Buster sat in his chair and looked at winning ticket again, hoping that his depression might prove to be just an ephemeral thing, that some of his earlier joy might return. But the picture on the box seemed to have faded, dulled. The brightest color in evidence was a smear of Myrtle's blood across the flanks of the two-horse. He took the top off and looked inside. He was shocked to see that the little tin horses were leaning sadly every which way. Their colors had also faded. A broken bit of spring poked through the hole where you inserted the key to wind the machinery. "Someone's been in here," his mind cried. "Someone's been at it. One of them. Ruining me wasn't enough. They had to ruin my game, too." But a deeper voice, perhaps the fading voice of sanity, whispered that this was not true. "This is how it was from the very start," the voice whispered. "You just didn't see it." He went back to the closet, meaning to take down the gun after all. It was time to use it. He was feeling around for it when the telephone rang. Buster picked it up very slowly, knowing who was on the other end. Nor was he disappointed. "Hello, Dan," said Mr. Gaunt. "How are you this fine evening?" "Terrible," Buster said in a glum, draggy voice. "The world has turned to boogers. I'm going to kill myself."
"Oh?"
Mr. Gaunt sounded a trifle disappointed, nothing more. "Nothing's any good. Even the game you sold me is no good." "Oh, I doubt that very much," Mr. Gaunt replied with a touch of asperity. "I check all my merchandise very carefully, Mr. Keaton, very carefully indeed. Why don't you look again?" Buster did, and what he saw astounded him. The horses stood up straight in their slots. Each coat looked freshly painted and glistening. Even their eyes seemed to spark fire. The tin race course was all bright greens and dusty summer browns. "The track looks fast," he thought dreamily, and his eyes shifted to the box top. Either his eyes, dulled by his deep depression, had tricked him, or the colors there had deepened in some amazing way in the few seconds since the telephone had rung. Now it was Myrtle's blood he could barely see. It was drying to a drab maroon.
"My God," he whispered.
"Well," Mr. Gaunt asked. "Well, Dan, am I wrong? Because if I am, you must defer your suicide at least long enough to return your purchase to me for a full refund. I stand behind my merchandise. I have to, you know. I have my reputation to protect, and that's a proposition I take very seriously in a world where there's billions of them and only one of me."
"No, no,"
Buster said. It's beautiful."
"Then you were in error?" Mr. Gaunt persisted.
I guess I must have been."
"You admit you were in error?"
Yes." "Good," Mr. Gaunt said. His voice lost its edge. "Then, by all means, go ahead and kill yourself. Although I must admit I'm disappointed. I thought I had finally met a man who had guts enough to help me kick their asses. I guess you're just a talker, like all the rest." Mr. Gaunt sighed. It was the sigh of a man who realizes he has not glimpsed light at the end of the tunnel after all. A strange thing was happening to Buster Keaton. He felt his vitality and purpose surging back. His own interior colors seemed to be brightening, intensifying again.
"You mean it's not too late?
You must have skipped Poetry 101. 'Tis never too late to seek a newer world. Not if you're a man with some spine. Why, I had everything all set up for you, Mr. Keaton. I was counting on you, you see." "I liked plain old Dan a lot better," Buster said, almost shyly.
"All right, Dan.
Are you really set on making such a cowardly exit from life?
No, Buster cried. It's just, I thought, what's the use? There's too many of them.
Three good men can do a lot of damage, Dan.
Three? Did you say three?
Yes, there's another of us. Someone else who sees the danger, who understands what they are up to.
Who? Buster asked eagerly. Who?
In time, Mr. Gaunt said, but for now, time is in short supply.
They'll be coming for you.